Lima, Coast to Coast, Show 37, December 10th, 2006. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before getting into our interviews, I'd like to remind everybody there are four ways to contact the podcast. First is via email at podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com, via the website www.thelemacoasttocoast.com, via voicemail 206-600-5782, and via the postal system at Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, 30065, and that's in the U.S. Thelema Coast to Coast also has a MySpace page. It can be addressed at www.myspace.com/ThelemaCoastToCoast, and there is a Frapper map where hundreds of listeners have identified their locations, and that can be found on the website at www.thelemacoasttocoast.com. Okay, so obviously it has been a month since I've put the last podcast out, received a number of emails saying when's the podcast coming out, etc. Unfortunately, I've just been really busy with school and work and so forth, and the semester stuff. And, you know, as much as I like the podcast to come out every 2 weeks or so, it really comes out when I have time to do it. And so lately I've been really busy, and so this is the first chance I've had to get the podcast out. I hope to have one out just after Christmas, the last one for the 2006 year, and then moving into 2007, maybe doing them every other week or so, probably again until the last few weeks of the semester next spring. But we'll see how it goes, and it'll come out as soon as I have the material and the time to put it together. Okay, in the last show, number 36, as one listener said, I was whining about getting voicemails, and sure enough, I got a whole bunch of voicemails, so thank you all very much. It was great to receive them. So today's feedback, all of it, is going to be in voicemail. So the first one is for from Tony, and here's what he has to say.
Hi, John. This is Tony. I live in Alameda, California. I'm a pagan and a business owner, and I really enjoy listening to your podcast. I want to thank you very much for providing it out there. I've learned a tremendous amount listening to it. I know that you lost your voicemail number, and that is a something that has to be pointed out, that each of us has an impact. I've been meaning to leave you a voicemail, and I haven't done it. And because of that, in the last 90 days, nobody else has left you a voicemail. You've lost your voicemail number, and I'm sorry that that has happened, because I feel like my not leaving you a voicemail has caused this to happen. So I wanted to apologize for that. I've been thinking a lot about your conversations with Keith 418 and about the goals and the methods of your organization, the OTO, and I find it absolutely fascinating. I want to thank you that I always enjoy listening to them. I listen to them quite eagerly. And I wanted to point out to you, don't you think you're being a little hard on your leadership? Because I think most people don't have any goals. Most people in life have absolutely no connection between their present actions today with some future desired outcome. Most people, I would say, have no idea that if they eat a bowl of ice cream today, that in 10 to 20 years, they're going to have heart failure. And that lack of connection, I think, is something that plagues everybody. Unfortunately, when you know, when people without that consciousness acquire leadership positions, their lack of vision permeates the entire organization. So, unfortunately, it sounds like this has happened to the OTO. And if they acquire leadership in an organization that handles, you know, vast amounts of energy, such as the OTO, the results can be really a train wreck of fascinating proportions. So I would tell you, or I would suggest to you, that leaders of any organization really need vision and goals. When they do, people, like-minded persons, are attracted to that. They see that, they're attracted to that, they want to be part of that. And a huge change, even by a small group or a small organization, can occur. And unfortunately, the other side is true. When leaders with no vision or goals come into positions of leadership, they too attract people of similar energy, and the organization drifts downstream. So I'm a person who likes solutions. I don't like just identifying problems. So I do have a suggestion for you and Keith 418. And in evaluating the solution, I would suggest that, you know, since we cannot know the future, the proper question to ask when evaluating any decision is not, is this the right decision, is this the wrong decision, because we don't know yet, but is this decision going to move us in the right direction? So with that spirit, I would suggest that you create a shadow government, Britain, for example. The party out of power has a shadow prime minister, a shadow cabinet. They follow their compatriots very closely. They have their own platforms and position papers on what should be done next. And so that is one possibility. That way, when power shifts and people with vision who can articulate that and attract like-minded people acquire leadership positions, then they will have everything ready-made and ready to go. So, and if they do a good enough job in articulating their goals and their methods, they usually do get in. So anyway, those are my thoughts on the matter. And again, John and Keith, I want to thank you very much for your scintillating conversations. I really appreciate the podcast. Sorry for this long message. And 93.
Thanks for the comment, Tony, and I understand it being long and everything, but you had a lot to say, and that's great. I would disagree in that you say that, in general, people don't have goals. I think that's correct for lots of people in their personal lives. But I don't think that's really correct for organizations, or at least it hasn't been in my experience. So when you have leaders who are in charge of an organization, they really need to have kind of a direction for the organization, and especially if it's a nonprofit, because then it's obviously not about making money. It's going to have to be doing something, and who knows what the leaders of the OTO actually see it as. So the other thing is, in general, organizations don't claim to have initiations that cause people to be better. They don't use grand poobah type titles. So when the leaders use those kind of titles and they claim to have all of these initiatory achievements and processes going on, you'd think they could actually do more. And so that's why I think comparing them to just the average person or the average organization really is not apt, because the average person or organization doesn't claim to have these series of initiations, or they don't call themselves, you know, grand this or illustrious that. So you would think, you know, with a group that has both initiations and of those illustrious titles, that they would have something to show for it, but unfortunately they don't. Or at least not yet. We always can hope that they could, tomorrow they could come out with strategic goals. You know, it's only been quite a few years that they said they've been working on it. And I remember in 2001, 2002, saying that they should be coming out with goals. And in 2004, they said they would be coming out with goals. And in fact, on this show, at the end of the interview with Craig Berry, he said that they would be out by the end of last year. And here we are, the end of this year, and no strategic goals yet. But I guess they're busy. Anyway, as for your suggestion about the shadow government, that really doesn't strike me as appropriate for the OTO. The that might work well for some kind of democratically elected system or some kind of party system. But for an organization that supposedly the initiations and the magical praxis are what elevate people in their work, that seems to me to be more of what the basis of the government should be about in an organization like the OTO. So it just doesn't really seem that right to me. I would rather have the members hear about how to critically think, to go engage in the material. I'd rather have them read the books. I'd rather have them do the magic. I'd rather have them do all of those things so that they would be in a better position. So as they move into leadership roles within the organization, they can use those skills that they've gained from actually engaging in the material to help lead the order. Perhaps I'm too much of an optimist, but that's what I think would ultimately solve a lot of these problems. The next one is from Sor Isabel.
93, John. This is Sor Isabel. I wanted to leave a voicemail. I hadn't listened to the whole podcast. I just had to drop a line and tell Keith that was brilliant. Fucking brilliant. The discussion you guys had on the real world versus the fantasy world and equality and stuff like that. Totally on with you on that. And this is very incoherent because I'm driving. But anyway, I just wanted to let you know that I really appreciate it. Keep up the great work. Love is the law of Underworld.
Thank you for your comment. The comment from Keith about the real world and fantasy world and all of that. We see it a lot. A lot of people go into magic and thinking that, you know, it's like some fantasy Dungeons and Dragons or SCA or something like that, where you can go and role play, but then you have to go back to your real life. If you're actually doing magic, it gets integrated into your real life, so there shouldn't be any separation. So thanks for that comment. The next, I don't have a name from the caller on this one, and the caller is calling about show number 35, talking about transgression.
John, hi. First off, forgive me, I just listened to 35. I'm playing catch up. As of today, you released number 36. But this is in response to number 35. I wrote you an email, however, I understand that you want some more phone messages, so here you go. I'm reading my email to you on the phone. John, just listened to 35, enjoyed it as usual. Regarding transgression, ideology, culture versus cult, etc., I feel you and Keith are pretty dead on. However, what I really want to know is, what came first, the ignorant chicken or the magic egg? And how can we ensure that whatever hatches from that magic egg don't turn into another ignorant chicken? We are ignorant when we start the path, which is fine because we learn what we need to and carry on step by step. But some of us are also chickens when we avoid what scares us, and being a chicken will also keep us ignorant. Some people deal with their fears by taking on the role of evil and choose one hand over the other, and others deal with fear by taking on the role of good and get corrupted. The magical path can be terrifying no matter what allegiance you hold. One day you are soaring with wisdom and understanding, and the next you are in the cliffotic wasteland. If you teeter one way, you can be damn sure that you'll totter the other. Serious, sincere, spiritual seekers need to know the magic path is a very specialized art, with a capital A. Not a religion, not a dogma, not a jog in the park, not a party. Those are of culture and of cults. If you want enlightenment, you do not need to summon each of the goetic demons, but you will probably have to deal with their effect on you, whether they are actual separate conscious entities or psychological projections. I have to commit to this as a long-winded thing here. In fact, you do not need anything to reach enlightenment. You don't need to know any special words or rituals or any thought at all. The ecstasy that comes with the coagulation of magical symbols can be extremely exalting and gratifying. However, it is temporary. Crowley said, "Deliver us from evil and good." So you're an evil Satanist who hates Christianity and you want to be a vampire in an Anne Rice novel, fine. So you're a computer hacker D&D player who wants to hack the mind of God, fine. so your dope-smoking hippie who wants to reach the psychedelic haven promised by Timothy Leary, or a bearded yogi with a giant erection, or imaginative youth seduced by the mythos of Merlin and ancient wizards, or a power-hungry nerd who wants special powers, or a sexually repressed, insecure person who wants to release from the mental prison, fine. The magic art just may be for you. Know thyself. No one is equal, for each of us has an universe of our own, but we are all equal in our personal sovereignty. Beware of the ego traps and pitfalls of morbidity, most of them disguised as their opposites. In the jungle, there's a certain fungus that falls from the spikes on trees onto ants crawling on the jungle floor. When the fungus is absorbed by the ants and reaches their tiny brains, they mysteriously give up all their search for food and are inclined to do nothing but climb up the trunks of trees. When they reach a certain height, they bury their heads in the trunk where a spike grows out of them and releases a fungus again, continuing the cycle. I don't know if you will post this on your podcast, but do what thou wilt, shall be the whole of law. Great show.
Thanks for your comments. Your comments were interesting and stuff to think about, but I don't really think that there's much there for me to reply. So thanks for sending that. The next one is, I think the name is Marion.
Hello, John. This is Lauren calling in from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I really liked the interview that you did with Stephen Skinner a few episodes ago. I think it'd be great to hear more guests who are active in the ceremonial magic community, whether they're Thelemites or not. I think it's a refreshing break from the talk about OTO politics, which really only interests me in the respect that they address certain practical aspects of managing esoteric groups. Also, I've noticed there haven't been that many female guests on the show lately, and female listeners don't seem to be contributing feedback either. If I remember correctly, the last one on the show was months ago, calling in just to compliment you on your sexy voice. I know that plenty of women are listening because they're all over the Frapper map, but the issue is bigger than just Thelema coast to coast. Why do you think women are still so much less active than men are in this tradition? For instance, in the original Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, women were very active, and they were writing a lot of the material, too. It seems like in a lot of orders today, not only are women a minority, but they are almost entirely absent from leadership positions. I've seen it firsthand in esoteric groups I've been involved with, and frankly, I find it disturbing. Is there any possibility of getting a woman who's an experienced ceremonial magician to come speak on the show and give her views on this disparity? My own work has forced me to see just how much cultural conditioning I've followed growing up female in this society. The kinds of issues I'm confronted with often just aren't the same as what my male friends are dealing with in their work. So, keep the podcast coming, and please get some more women on the show.
Thanks for the voicemail, Marion. In regard to your questions are why there's so few females, it's because I don't think there actually are a lot of practicing female magicians. I can think of maybe a handful of them, but the majority of the people out there are men. And I would love for that to change. I would love to see women getting serious. But it seems to me that there is other priorities, especially many, many, many of the women that I've seen in the OTO. They don't prioritize the material. They don't prioritize the magic. They're more interested in social engagement and making friends and things like that. So I think that's one of the reasons that you don't see a lot of women on the show. And if you women out there disagree, feel free to call and leave voicemail and tell me otherwise. But yeah, I mean, I've certainly have had a handful of women on the show, even including Anna Kriya from Core Lucas, and I've had a few others. But yeah, in general, I don't think there's a lot of women out there who are doing a lot of serious, meaningful, magical work. At least not that you see any of the results from. You don't see any courses, any books, any websites, any writings, you know, it's just not out there. So there are exceptions, but the exceptions kind of prove the rule. So if you women want to change that, get serious about the material and start engaging. Keith told me this story about a woman he was talking to about this, and he said, you know, we'll go out and find an instructor. And she's like, well, I've tried male instructors and it just didn't work out. And he's like, well, then go get a female instructor. And she's like, oh, they're worse. So what are you going to do? You've got to find some kind of guru, some kind of instructor, some kind of person, a teacher, even if it's only for certain aspects, you know, go find somebody or be the teacher you want to find. You got to do work. So anyway, I'm sure that'll piss a bunch of people off, and feel free to send feedback. Okay, the next one is a voicemail from Nathan. And Nathan is the person who called in the previous podcast and was complaining that there wasn't enough stuff about magic. Then Keith and I spoke about that. So here's Nathan's further comments.
Hey, John. Hey, Keith 418. I guess I hit a nerve with my last mail. What I was really driving at is that, you know, I'd be interested in hearing more things of the technical nature. Didn't necessarily mean that you guys needed to start giving instructions or step-by-steps on how to, you know, do things that people could easily buy books to learn. No, I just meant more like discussion of the you know, the technical topics. 10,000-foot overview, as it were. One of the things that I've heard y'all mention is that there are a lot of people who, you know, who haven't done the reading. And I can completely understand that, you know, you probably get questions of that nature all the time. How do I do this particular step? I really just meant more like discuss, you know, what is the bulk of Crowley's work? What is, what are the calls? Talk about Enochian magic, you know. Things from a 10,000-foot point view, and give people an idea of where to go and look up info. You know, more like a guide. But anyway, I'm enjoying the podcast, and I'll be enjoying hearing of your stuff in the future. Have a great night. Bye.
Thanks again, Nathan. I guess we might have misunderstood you. Today's show might actually be closer to what you're thinking, but maybe not. I don't know. So, you know, listen to this show, and if you like it, let me know. If you don't, let me know. Either way. And the last one is a listener named Dave, who is in Texas.
Big John, 93. It's Dave Blakely down in Dallas, Texas. I just want to take a moment to thank you for the interview with Christopher Knowles last time. I passed by the copy of the Guitar Mag with the interview in it a couple of times and said, there's nothing in there that I don't already know about, so I'd walk by it. But based on the interview with him, I went ahead and picked it up, and I did really enjoy it. The sidebar with Jimmy alone was well worth the cover price. So I just want to thank you, man. Thank you for all the work that you do, and I'll talk to you soon. 93.
Thanks for the voicemail, Dave. I'm glad you liked the interview with Christopher Knowles. It was really fascinating. Chris sent me a PDF of the article before it was released, and it's some really fascinating, wonderful information. And I'm a big fan of the Lucifer Rising that Paige did. I've had it for quite a while. I used to use it as background when I was doing tarot card readings and things like that. So it's great for getting into trances. So thanks for the comment, and thanks to everybody who left voicemail. I'm not going to whine as much on this show about sending them, but please do. I really like getting the voicemails. Okay, so now we're going to move into the interviews. First one is with Keith. He and I talk about magic as a religion, and then we kind of go into some other points. The conversation that I had with Keith kind of sprung from the conversation I had with the other guest that's on this show, an interview with Roger Williamson. Roger is an author of a number of books and recordings, a painter. He's also the owner of Magus Books in Minneapolis, and that's at magusbooks.com. Roger, he kind of shies away from looking at magic as a religious thing, and he even uses different languages. Instead of saying a ritual or ceremony, he uses machines, as in kind of a mechanistic process to get people into certain mind states or certain views. So that kind of spawned the conversation that Keith and I had. So first we'll start with Keith, and we'll look at magic and kind of the religious aspect, and then we'll go into the interview with Roger Williamson. So here's Keith.
Keith, welcome back to the podcast, 93.
93, John, thanks for having me.
The other main guest on the show is Roger Williamson, and we talk about his personal magic system. And he makes the assertion that magic isn't religious, and he tries to get away from religious connotations and religious language. What do you think is the relationship between religion and magic?
Well, that's a question that would take a really long time to answer. You could do a whole book about that. I think magic is interesting in that, or the question is significant in that, if we look at magic and magical praxis, it both seems to affirm certain religious ideas and at the same time to call them into question, to undermine them. And there's a contradiction or a paradox in that magicians often have to operate by using the tropes and totems and trappings and ideals even within various religious systems, and yet at the same time their work tends to call into question religious faith. And magic is always sort of seen as opposed to religion in that it's a kind of an underground private religious practice that seeks to use religious tools or ideals for personal gain and benefit, kind of at the expense of religion. That's often how it's viewed, especially in Western cultures. So how does that really relate to a magician's approach to religion? There are some magicians who are very religious in conventional terms. They pray, they go to church, and they use their religious spiritual approaches in their magic. And then there seems to be other magicians who are very anti-religious and who seek to attack and undermine religious ideals. And it's almost as though their power was coming from their hostility to religion. So we see magicians on both sides of that fence, that divide. And I think that that's, you know, worth taking some time to look at.
Now, do you think that magic, or ceremonial magic in particular, is more of a tool that can be wielded by the religious or the irreligious or the anti-religious? Is it a means to get to an end, or is it some kind of metaphysical system in itself?
I guess what I would be looking at is what guides the magical praxis. When we look at Crowley's definition of magic, magic, he tells us, is the art and science of creating change in conformity to will. So we wonder, why do we want to change certain things and leave other things alone? What changes do we want to see? What kind of profound changes do we want to make? One of the pieces that I've been working on is looking at the various vectors of how different social groups or social classes approach magic. And you can see people that are sort of poor and lower middle class or not very well educated tend to use magic to deal primarily with the, you know, day-to-day problems of their ordinary lives. You know, you read about people doing candle-burning magic to get magical partners or sex partners, and people do little spells to get a new car, and they were very sort of mundane material aid kind of practices, which people can spend their entire lives sort of enmeshed in. And then in the second tier, the more middle-class people tend to see magic as a religious issue, where they go to magical churches and attend a sort of magical religious services. And that's really their focus, is on dealing with the bureaucratic nature of those sorts of group activities that seem very close to conventional religion, or imitate them in to a great extent. And then on a higher level, you see people who are very much involved with the philosophy and the sort of Gnostic ideals of magic and looking beyond just the sort of churchy experience. And those three vectors sort of work simultaneously with each other and then sometimes seem to split off where they don't really know what the other one is doing. So all of those have certain religious dimensions to them. The kind of corporate worship, as my yoga teacher says, of the church is kind of counterbalanced with the very individual candle-burning, voodoo doll-making sort of private thing that's going on in the lower vector. And then in the high vector, you have people who are, you know, sort of trying to free themselves from the bounds of these other areas, and they're looking at the pure philosophical ideas and pure Gnostic ideas at the very top of the system. So it really depends on where you go and what your interests and needs are.
Do you think there's a hierarchy of development that you go in stages through one vector to another, or are there situations where you just completely skip aspects? Like, for instance, let's say you're middle class, and so you immediately approach magic as kind of a spiritual religion versus using it to, say, win a court case or, bring your lover back.
Well, the problem is that oftentimes the peasant sort of vector, or the pre-literate, very primitive vector, is seen as being extremely powerful. It has a palpable physicality to it. It has a very immediate experiential factor, which transfixes many middle-class people and makes them think that it's somehow more authentic than the sort of churchy approach that they would be naturally drawn to, and which they found arid over the course of their lives. So in many instances, you'll see people gravitating towards this lower sphere out of a quest for authenticity, a quest for a sort of primitive experience. And then after a while, they realize that there's not a lot going on there. It's a sort of gerbil hamster wheel all its own. In some areas, I think people gravitate towards the higher levels when they realize that the corporate mass worship is sort of a dead end, and that, you know, nice experiences with pleasant people in a sort of middle class environment that Crowley himself criticized bitterly in Magic Without Tears. And, you know, if you read his discussions of why these sorts of group activities are a bad idea, it's a very clear critique of middle class church life and experience. Go on and want to look at these higher things. I mean, one of the things that we keep asking is, you know, what directs your magic? What values direct your magic? You can say, I want to create change in conformity with my will, but what kind of change? Ultimately, where is it leading? You know, we talked about this in the last podcast. Who informs the direction that it's going in and to what end? And if you look in, for example, Liber 418, The Vision and the Voice, you see the vision of the arrow is this direction that everything's going in. And until people have these sorts of big picture revelations as to where everything's going, their magic tends to be limited to the conditions and problems and values and definitions that are sort of imposed upon them by their immediate universe.
Well, it just occurs to me, you know, in your description of the higher, I think there's also a danger there of somebody kind of getting lost in their head or losing their ground
of course.
So there's that world-affirming aspects that the lower ones have
right.
that kind of keep you grounded. So I think there's a necessity to be working all of them.
Right. Well, again, if you look at the people that sort of get caught up in this, what a friend of mine characterizes as sort of a Pythagorean or Platonic approach to magic, these are people who are trying to solve mental problems and not even noticing what's going on around them. And we see a lot of this, too, in the occult world of people who, you know, claim to be doing this advanced magical work with these ideas and concepts, and they're like acid heads. They're total lunatics who don't have any connection to reality. The ideals have ceased to mean anything. There's never any connection at all. I think that one of the ways people can look at this sort of issue is in the television show The Wire. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but you know, my wife and I were watching it the other night, and it occurred to me that in this current season, it's an HBO show, you've got the kids in Baltimore who are selling drugs, you've got the police who are sort of chasing them around, you've got the drug dealers who are controlling the drug trade in the city, and then you have politicians and developers who are sort of above them. And each episode mimics the different actions of all of the different levels that are operating within the city, so that the cops, what's going on with the cops are sort of what's going on with the kids, which is sort of going on with the teachers, which is sort of going on with the politicians, and all of them sort start to reflect each other. And there's a unity that comes out of that whole hierarchy where each level reflects the other. And that unity is the unity that you see in the universe when the cosmos and the microcosm start to sync up. I got to take this call.
Okay.
Right. And that moment, that vision of that unity can only happen when you're experienced in all three areas or as many areas as really as exist. I think it's significant also to look at what Michael Burdio does. He baits people with the Lucky Hoodoo book, which is, you know, how to win at the races, how to win court cases, you know, the sort of primitive voodoo stuff that we were talking about. And then gradually leads people into very, very advanced philosophical systems. And the immediate physical stuff is sort of like the fishhook. I mean, I talked to him about this very directly. I said, that's the fishhook that you bait people in to begin with, and then you see whether or not they can handle the more advanced material.
And he copped to that?
Oh, yeah. That's obvious. I mean, that's a very obvious thing. That's a no-brainer. But you're right, and the sort of, you know, ivory tower occultists are completely boring and ridiculous. They think they've evolved beyond sort of physical magical praxis, and we can see that they haven't, because they're not really creating change anymore. They're not, nothing in their environment is changing. These are the kinds of people who live in filth and in hovels, but talk about, you know, the mansions on the moon that they're going to build someday. We all know people like this. They're pathetic. That's not what we're about.
Well, what... Okay, if magic is this kind of changing the material realm, and you one could characterize religion as dealing with the transcendent realm, don't you think there is still a necessity for some kind of way of dealing with the transcendent and maybe co-opting some religious aspects? I mean, I keep thinking of the aims of religion, the method of science. So there's still that aspect of religion's desire for interacting with the transcendent, and that magic and science and scientific illuminism is a mechanism for doing that.
Oh, I think it is, and I think Crowley actually gives us a really great way to approach religion qua religion in Liber Astarte, which is very strict, very disciplined bhakti yoga. I don't know anyone who's experimented with that book in particular and hasn't gotten a lot out of it. So that's where you go to really do the religious stuff in a scientific sense. But the larger question is, can you use the material realm to influence the transcendent realm? And can you use the transcendent realm to influence the material realm? And magicians say yes to both. Our praxis as magicians is really involved in getting up into the transcendent realm to manipulate the material realm. And it's using pieces and tools in the material realm to have an effect on the transcendent realm.
Mm-hmm.
Because ultimately there's a unity. That's what the ladder, the hermetic ladder going up from the earth to the heavens is ultimately about. You can go both ways, up and down the tree of life. And my yoga teacher always startled me by reversing the direction at which he was traveling on the tree of life. You know, most of us see ourselves down in Malkuth, working to get up into Yezod, working to get up into Hod, you know, this sort of slog up the side of the mountain. And he would always say, well, depends on which way you're coming. Or I'm in Bina now, and I'm trying to get down into Hod. Or I'm in Hokmah now, and I'm trying to get down into Tiferet. And by reversing the direction, you sort of could conceive of a path and an approach that was totally different from the one that you were used to. It's a different set of problems, it's a different set of issues. But nonetheless, this is sort of the question, where's the direction coming from? You know, we often talk about the difference between definitions of essence. You know, what does essence really mean? Does it mean the aim or direction of a thing? When we say this is the thing's essence, what are we talking about? Well, I've been experimenting with the idea of essence as aim or direction. So where does the aim or direction ultimately come from? And my problem with most religious approaches is that it's just propagation. It's just unthinking, you know, God created us, so we're going to make God happy, and don't think too much about this. And that's not Gnostic or magical. Gnostic and magic explores the origins of these things and seeks out their essence and their direction and then uses it.
Well, wouldn't will and or desire be large components that would be directing these things?
Of course. Heidegger tells us that all things have their essential power in and through the will.
Okay, so obviously it's the will that's informing the magic and is setting the trajectory of where the individual is going.
Right, and
but it's also this circular
around
thing where you have to use magic to help understand your will, and it's your will that informs your magic. So it's a recursive kind of iterative process.
Uh-huh, yeah, and ultimately it all reinforces itself. And there are moments that you see what I used to describe as the perversity of the universe, where everything in the universe would start imitating every other aspect of it. And the symmetries that appear within that are, I think, modeled in C.F. Russell's cube designs, where you see symmetrical hologrammatic patterns that emerge throughout the way the cube is structured, which imitate those hologrammatic thematic parts of the universe, which we run into in circumstances and in terms of our life, where coincidences and issues keep repeating themselves.
Right.
So that we can't escape from the universe because it's always doing the same thing. It has that unity.
Right, and that even kind of gets into that eternal return aspect where things keep coming back in that cyclic nature and we keep getting thrust into the same situations.
Yeah. Yeah, and the same people return. My yoga teacher used to joke when we would start talking about the similarities of various people, he'd say, there's only 120,000 real people in the world anyway.
Where would he get that number from?
I think from Revelation.
Oh, okay.
144,000, yeah.
Yeah, 144.
There's only 144,000 real people in the world anyway. So within that group, you're going to constantly see, you know, characters and personalities and people start returning. And as you get older, I think you tend to see the same patterns emerge more and more frequently. I think this is why older people have the benefit of certain wisdom, because you know, the older you get, the more you see patterns continue to return. And I think, you know, people sometimes will say to you and me, oh, I can't see how you saw that coming, or how could you have predicted that, or all your predictions came true. And we sort of smile because we've seen it all how many times before over
right.
the last 20 years. So.
Right. It's recognizing the patterns and even looking for patterns and know that there are going to be patterns to see.
Yeah, and that there you can kind of count on the pattern to return again, and riding those patterns and following those patterns and evoking and invoking those patterns is part of what magicians do.
But one of the things that kind of presupposes those patterns is a subsuming structure in which the magician is working in, or reality, that there's a structure to reality that we're all inhabiting.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
I think a lot of people dislike that idea that there's some subsuming structure that, you know, that things are ordered within.
Well, they think that they're trapped by that. They think of it as a cage that they have to escape from. And my yoga teacher's response to this always was, I really think that they would be very unhappy if the cells in their body started acting chaotically, stopped obeying physical laws and doing things. We're dependent on those structures, you know, in terms of the cellular fabric of our bodies and everything else. And if we don't have those patterns, and if we're not part of that system, we would all die. So we depend on those patterns, sort of like children depend on their parents, and we get angry and upset because the parents won't let us do everything we want. But in reality, if the parents were gone, we'd be dead. And that's sort of the irony there.
Mm-hmm.
I also think people that kind of rebel against the structure of the universe tend to, for the most part, not see all the parts of it that are there. They're only focusing on one particular part that they have a problem with. And the issue with the hologram is that if you start tinkering with one part, you tinker with the whole part. If you have a problem with one part, you really have a problem with the whole. And people run into this a lot with Crowley's teachings, where they think they can get rid of one part, not realizing that it keeps replicating itself everywhere throughout the rest of the system that they're in.
Right.
So they think they can discard it, and they keep coming back to it over and over again.
Right, and they also think that, you know, well, if I change this one thing, it's only this one thing, but they don't understand the implications and the repercussions of changing just one small thing.
Uh-huh, yeah, and they run into problems, and then, you know, either have to go back and look at what they did or not. We've all done this. I mean, this isn't a new experience for any of us. If you've been doing magic for some time at all, you've run into this problem, and you come to cope with it, but...
All right, well, that sounds good. I think we've covered a lot on today's podcast. Thanks for being on the show again.
No problem. Thanks for having me, John. 93.
That was a little longer than the normal conversation I have with Keith, but I thought it was very interesting and going in a lot of good directions, so that's why I played it. Let me know what you all think. And as I said, here is the interview with Roger Williamson. He is part owner of MagusBooks.com. And a practicing magician, author, painter, et cetera, et cetera. I've known Roger for a number of years, and he's a great guy and full of information. So here's the interview.
We have on the phone with us Roger Williamson, author and proprietor of Magus Books. Welcome to the show, 93.
Well, thanks a lot, John.
Now, you have come out with a number of books. I guess one of the first is Howling at the Sky, also The Sun at Night, Lucifer Diaries, and most recently, The Black Book of the Jackal.
Correct, yeah.
These books are kind of an embodiment of your own personal magical system. Can you first give a little background of how you got into magic and what your foundations of magic were?
Well, I taught the basic techniques back since before I can remember, really, by my folks, especially my mom, who taught me astral projection and using short story formats for astral projection. Also, they'd take me, at that time I looked on it as being dragged around all these ancient sites and things like that. So that was really how it all started for me. My mom died when I was pretty early, and so there wasn't the same focus there after she died, I don't think. And then my teenage revolt was to throw all that away and go off and play rock and roll. And then probably years later, it's funny how life sort of comes around, probably my late 20s, things came back and sort of hit me on the back of the head and woke me up, you know.
So your foundation was more kind of a mysticism than a structured kind of magical practice?
Oh, no, I'd say it was very magical, yeah.
Okay.
She brought me up very much in Golden Dawn techniques and that kind of thing.
Okay, so she was familiar with that and had done those kind of practices.
Correct, yeah.
Moving away from those more established practices of kind of the Golden Dawn and moving into your own system, what was the motivation or what caused you to start going in your own particular path?
Well, I think it was just a natural flow. I think, you know, there are plenty of systems out there, whether it's the Golden Dawn, the Aurum Solis, and my belief is that they all bring you to pretty much the same place, that they're there to encourage their members or participants or however they want to look at it, and that then you go out and basically create your own system or universe. You know, I'm sure there's folks that perhaps feel that, you know, things should be rigid and just kept that way, but to me, magic has always been a lot more closer to shamanism. I don't really think it has anything to do with religion at all.
So you make a difference between kind of a religious faith or belief system and then a more pragmatic or more scientific?
I mean, the magician is God.
Uh-huh.
In that, the magician determines how he or she will perceive their universe. Therefore, they're creating or choosing how they perceive their reality.
But you just said creation, so I guess you still have kind of an assumption that the magician is a creator being, I guess, kind of like God then.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so there really isn't then any need to bow down to any other form of deity, is there?
All right.
Now, that isn't to say that, you know, the magician wouldn't say that there are, you know, energies, or however we want to look at these, that we can be empowered by. You know, I mean, if we look at the Kabbalah, I mean, that's an interesting model for where we can look at these diverse energies, learn to recognize them so that, you know, when we need them, we know how to get them. So it's pretty much like, say, having a toolbox. You need a hammer, right?
Mm-hmm.
You just go to the toolbox and get the hammer.
Okay, so you kind of see a lot of this as more tools to kind of get you to a particular conscious level or a particular state of being, or
yeah,
how would you?
I mean, I don't. I mean, to me, it's about being alive.
Okay.
And you know, we can be perhaps preoccupied with all kinds of things, but I mean, to me, magic has always been more that it brings us more into life rather than removing us from it.
So it's kind of a world affirming.
It encourages life to be more adventurous.
Okay.
You know, if we are looking at a system, how creative are its members? If its members are creative, it's probably a pretty valid system. Right?
Right. And now, when you're saying creative, creative in what way?
Well, I mean, it could be in accounting, or it could be painting, it could be writing, you know, whatever, you know, avenue that you feel drawn to, you know?
Right. So you, within your conception of magic and how you've been working, even somebody who's, you know, excelling at, you just said accounting or maybe even chemistry or
oh, sure, yeah.
You know, bioengineering, that could be a form of magical creation.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, I guess in your particular avenues of creation, you've created a number of books. Also some paintings and some audio recordings. And one of the things that you mentioned earlier that I thought is really fascinating is, whereas like a lot of the Golden Dawn books and so forth are very structured rituals, do this, do this, do this, or non-fiction kind of essays explaining things, you take a more kind of parable or narrative approach. Can you expand on that in your magical practice and how
well,
that plays out?
Well, I feel, you know, a lot of folks talk about, you know, magic being the union of, you know, of like science and art, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the scientific part is the memorization, which I think is crucial, of these different workings, rituals, or machines, as I like to call them, to move away from the religious context. And then also, you know, to have the fire created by either different works of art, stories, and things like this. And so this is where this union comes in. You know, it can get very boring for folks, I feel, to constantly be having to memorize this stuff. And then sometimes it just takes, you know, a story or a short story or a movie or a painting or a piece of music to really inspire people to sort of get them fired up, or any of us, to just keep, you know, to keep going.
So you see the short story as a means of inspiration or
oh,
kind of
a
guided
meditation?
I think
that all forms of, you know, all stories can be forms of revelation. They don't have to be, you know, traditional so-called religious books like the Bible or the Quran, you know?
Okay.
I mean, I think you can look at, let's say, Hesse's Damien or Faust's The Magus and say that, you know, these are forms or, you know, texts of revelation, you know?
Okay. So in your particular case, you use short stories frequently. Now, also in your
I'd say that I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, please, go ahead.
I'd say it has a lot to do with setting the mood. You know, so we perhaps have our workspace and we have our candles and incense and things like this. And, you know, the short story, which I feel that perhaps a lot of folks have sort of taken and used as, like, say, guided meditations for path workings and things like this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They all go towards sort of setting the mood and inspiring, you know?
Okay. Now, in your book, Lucifer Diaries, you used a different format for a portion of the book, and you've actually done excerpts from your personal diaries?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, and a lot of this is during some workings that you were doing with particular deities, I guess, working with various aspects of Enochian?
Yeah, they do that. I mean, I don't know what these I don't know what these entities or energies are, but I find that they are inspiring, life-enriching, you know, and encourage creativity. What they are, I don't really know, but you know, to me, it's sort of like a car engine, right? You can still enjoy the car without necessarily understanding the physics of an internal combustion engine, you know?
Right. Okay. But also I notice in your books, especially in Lucifer Diaries, there's a tremendous amount of Kabbalah that you include in this.
Well, I use that as a framework, because I think, you know, the Kabbalah is a great model for sort of referencing perhaps where we are. You know, we'd say that we're composed of the Tree of Life, so we're in all of it simultaneously, but we do have focuses at times. And, you know, for trying to try and confirm astral experiences, I think it's a great tool. So if we're, say, doing a working of Venus, and then, you know, after the experience, we check all the correspondences and we find that everything seems to be concerned with, let's say, Saturn, and then we know that we've done something wrong in the working.
Okay.
And so then hopefully we can look at that, go back into how we've done it and correct it.
So again, you kind of see the Kabbalah as an objective kind of tool to compare the work to, but it isn't necessarily kind of a mystical system in itself, or
no, I don't think so. I don't. To me, it's, as I say, it's just one model out of many, and you know, it's there more as a reference system. It's just that I feel that magic is, you know, it just seems that there are so many books out there and so many people giving their opinion on it and trying to sort of let you know how much they think they know, rather than, you know, encouraging people to sort of perhaps find their own way and to get more involved in life and to make life more adventurous. You know, I don't think that it's performing the magical techniques that are important. It's the results that come from it, you know.
Okay. Now, you said you also have done some paintings?
Yes, yeah.
How does painting, and work into your system, and in particular, what kind of painting projects have you engaged in?
Well, I'm presently working on a major Arcana tarot deck.
Okay.
And I do have some of those images up in a portfolio on absolutearts.com.
Okay, well, we'll have a link to that then.
Okay, and then, but to me, it's almost sort of like an exorcism. That, you know, that you're externalizing different experiences or irritations and things like that. So it's a little bit like being, you know, an oyster, where you're sort of irritated by a grain of sand, and hopefully at the end of the day you're going to create a pearl, you know.
Where did you learn your techniques from? Are you self-taught, or did you...
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's... you know, it's a bit... to me, it's always a little bit like looking at clouds. You know, what do you see in the clouds? You know, so that's how I tend to look at it, you know.
Okay.
And I generally feel that, boy, I mean, you just keep putting enough paint on and something's going to come out.
That's true. Whether or not people want to look at it is a...
Well, but yeah, and then, of course, you know, who's to say what, you know, what's right and wrong or good and bad, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I think it's more that, you know, rather than us being preoccupied if somebody wants, whether they want to read our books or what number it gets up to on the bestseller list or you know, how many people sort of like your artwork, that's not really important, is it? I don't think, you know.
Right, right. One of the things that your book, Howling at the Sky and The Sun at Midnight and Lucifer Diaries, they seem to have... A very kind of similar, I'm sure some people have called it Luciferian aspect to it. And then the Black Book of the Jackal is a distinctly Egyptian book. How do you, but Egyptian book with Kabbalistic references in it, how do you kind of reconcile all of this together? Or what do you call your system, first of all, and how do you reconcile it all?
Well, I suppose Lucifer, you know, for want of a better word, I suppose it's as good as any other. And it's, you know, if you think of that, I mean, it's about the sort of rebellious type of spirit, isn't it?
Okay.
But, you know, if you were saying that you're going to be Luciferian, then you wouldn't necessarily have, you know, a set rituals that everybody did, because the idea would be to encourage individuality. And so everybody would be agreeing that they were all different. I suppose it's a bit like chaos magic, isn't it? You know, I mean, does it really make sense to have organized groups in chaos magic?
Yeah, that seems to be kind of antithesis of what chaos magic
right.
is about.
And so I'd say with this that, you know, that you can have individual thinkers coming together and agreeing to differ, and hopefully you'd all be bouncing ideas off each other and sort of enriching your own sort of universes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose, for want of a better word, Luciferian's probably as good as anything else, yeah. And of course it always, you know, to those of us perhaps who feel a little on the outside of things, it's always sort of encouraging and exhilarating to sort of have that sort of rebel connotation, isn't it, you know? Right, a bit like...
Right.
Like early rock and roll and stuff like that, you know.
Right. Well, where do you see your magical system evolving into? You know, do you see if there's any kind of trajectory where this is going?
No, not at all. It's not something that I've really concerned myself with, you know. As I say, it's a little bit like breathing. You know, it's a way of life, and it's something I do, and I tend to find it very rewarding. I find it sort of stimulates creativity, and it sort of makes life a lot, you know, more interesting. So I'm not necessarily, I can't say it's anything that sort of crosses my mind about where it might be going. I don't necessarily think that's important, you know.
Well, what have been the influences on your magical practice?
Being alive, probably. I mean, I've, I've always found life very exciting. You know, I know a lot of people are preoccupied about where they've been and where they might be going. You know, or whether they're being abducted by aliens or they're from Atlantis, you know, but, you know, at the end of the day, this may be the only time we experience the universe, you know, and so my thoughts have always been, well, you know, how am I going to sort of enjoy that experience, you know?
All right. Well, let's take a look at each of your books and so people can be aware of what's out there and perhaps go in and pick a few of them up. So,
terrific.
Let's start with Howling at the Sky, your draconian architectures and the Sabian Keys.
Right.
What was the ideas that inspired that book, or what's contained in that book?
Well, the idea was to sort of give a basic background of magical techniques where I felt that its origins lay, given examples of basic workings, the material that could be memorized, and then interspersing that with what I look on as short story guided meditations, so which people can read and hopefully be inspired by.
Okay. Now, you've also released a limited edition CD at one point that had a number of these short stories
correct.
Read by you.
Yeah, it's got the three stories from Howling at the Sky set to electronic music. And actually, if you get the hardcover edition of the Lucifer Diaries, it does come with a complimentary CD.
Okay. Well, since you said Lucifer Diaries, let's go to that one next.
Okay.
What is the Lucifer Diaries about?
Well, I always felt that, you know, we have all these experiences, whether it's dreams, astral experiences, experiences in life, and they, by and large, tend to be viewed by most of us as independent and individual experiences. Whereas I think if you write them down and then you look at them over a period of time, you start to realize that all these experiences are interrelated and that you start to get a thread and it becomes story-like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the concept behind that. And also looking at the possibilities of what these entities we think we communicate with might be. And if we look through history, you know, we hear of people being drawn up to heaven, people abducted into the fairy realm, and now people abducted by aliens. And I feel that there is, you know, it's all the same phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wanted to, you know, to present that as an idea.
Now, Eschaton put out The Sun at Midnight.
The Sun at Night, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry,
that was
The Sun at Night.
Second edition. The first edition came out in about 89.
Okay. And this is... I guess, closer to a collection of your short stories and kind of meditations?
Well, The Sun at Night is just a long short story.
Okay.
All right.
And what's the background of it?
Well, it's sort of I'd always like to think that it's sort of an inspiring tale of an individual being involved in life, confronted with situations, realizing how magical life can be. And so it's very much, I would say, sort of an adventure story.
In the whole
It has been called like a Luciferian parable, yeah.
Luciferian parable.
Yeah.
Okay. And I guess the most recent one put out by Magus Media is a reissue of the Black Book of the Jackal.
Yes, yeah. And that was, again, it was looking at the Kabbalah and the Egyptian Book of the Dead and looking at correlations between them. And a couple of chapters from the Egyptian Book of the Dead and the Kabbalah, and I sort of welded them together into sort of these like planetary workings that individuals can work through. Again, much like I suppose a lot of groups would do, whether it was the Golden Dawn or other groups, that sort of bring you to a place. And once you're at that place, you can then, I feel, experiment and strike out on your own.
Well, since you've been talking a number of times about going out on your own and building on your foundation and the Golden Dawn material and so forth that you learned in your youth, how did you go about kind of formulating your own system?
Well, you know, in between, you know, in my teens and 20s, of course, I'd had sort of a, perhaps the word is interesting, interesting adventures, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think initially, we have to, it's imperative to memorize the basics. If it's ceremony or magic you're interested in, it's imperative to memorize the material, which would include, you know, the basic Hebrew letters for the Kabbalah, the correspondences, the elemental workings. These should all be committed to memory so that you can reel them off. So you can be anywhere in the world. You can be sitting on a plane, in a hotel room, wherever, and you have everything you need memorized.
Okay.
And I find that in that way, that what happens is all kinds of ideas come to you, and you can start playing with them and using the Kabbalah and toying with these things, and it becomes an internal experience. If you don't have the material memorized, then you don't get an opportunity for all these concepts to coagulate and start moving into other areas.
Okay, so you're kind of seeing as the traditional structure of the Kabbalah and astrology and all of those symbolic systems.
Sure.
Is kind of the springboard to kind of go off into your own in
right.
your own direction.
I mean, it's like if you want to be original in story writing or music, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a command of language or musical knowledge, you're hardly going to be able to do it, are you?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I feel that this is no different, you know. But again, I mean, I feel that all these techniques, although we do have quiet moments, they should be encouraging us to be more adventurous and moving more out into life rather than to be withdrawing from life. I think I've always felt that it's really important that life should be adventurous.
Mm-hmm.
And some people look on that as being one of the dangers of magic, that we perhaps get ourselves into situations that we perhaps wouldn't normally get into. But I feel that it's all a form of testing, and it's through this testing, going through these gates or sephiroth or arets from the Egyptian Book of the Dead, that, you know, that we're challenged and we grow. And I feel that that's what's important, you know.
So if somebody took the time and memorized this material,
right,
just to kind of sum up what you're saying, they should, by working with the material, they should start getting inspired, and they should start getting ideas for experiments and kind of pulling on their own creativity and their own will and their own manifestation to create things from themselves.
Their own experiences, you bet. Yeah, I mean, I think that really all these things come from within. You know, there are things that we can be influenced by outside, but I'd say that all true magical experiences we generally get on our own and find within ourselves. And by having these, you know, if we want to call them path workings or astral experiences, you know, we're tapping these perhaps deeper levels that shaman would go to, and you know, and then we can perhaps check through gematria and find all these correspondences which initially seem to be like looking for the end of a piece of string. But it's through doing this, and I think thinking about these numbers and these correspondences that we have memorized, that eventually we start coming up with our own concepts, which might, you know, it might be just our way of looking at something that's, you know, that's been there for, you know, for God knows how long. But it's important because we've discovered it for ourselves, you know.
So I'm kind of getting that you have these various ideas, experiences, and then you start understanding through the work that you've done, memorizing and working with the structures, that you start seeing the relationships, and it's through those relationships that the meaning starts to reveal itself.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do you see in your future? Are you working on any other books right now? You mentioned working on the tarot.
Yeah, that's sort of taken up most of my time, and the thing about... you know, I'd love to be able to perhaps do... I have some odd ideas for perhaps other books, but, you know, it's such a commitment to have to sort of sit down and do that, you know, because you've got to sort of get yourself into the mindset, or I do, sort of get into the zone And so if I'm deciding to write a book, then that's all I'm going to do. And I just haven't got myself into that mindset to do another one yet.
Right.
Whereas I find the painting a lot more rewarding. It's more immediate. You know, people can look at them and draw their own conclusions about them, you know.
Okay.
Rather than trying to sort of, you know, I think there's always a danger in writing books that you're sort of, you know, telling people how things are and what they should be doing, rather than perhaps, you know, a picture which can, you know, inspire people into their own way of things, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, if somebody wanted to get a copy of these books, how would they get in touch with you?
Well, they can, they're able to order them all through Magus Books, which is magusbooks.com.
Uh-huh.
And they're all readily available there. There is a blog on there which can also lead you to absolutearts.com. And as I said earlier, there's some images of the tarot cards up there.
All right.
Or if people want to email me, that's fine. Roger@magusbooks.com, and I can, you know, send them those links and, you know, perhaps elucidate perhaps more some of the topics of the books, you know.
Fantastic. Wonderful. Well, I appreciate you being on the show and talking about your books and your system and hopefully inspiring some people to get really engaged in the material and kind of embrace, you know, reality as it is and start working and, you know, hopefully go out and start manifesting their own magical practice. So
thanks for giving me the opportunity to sort of sound off here, John.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you later. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
93.
Bye-bye.
So that brings us to the end of another podcast. Thanks for listening, and thanks for everybody being patient and waiting for show 37 to come out. The outgoing music is another rap song by a scholar who was on this program and has been featured a number of times. He released a song called Trust, and his music comes out with from a company called 156 Productions in Las Vegas, and I've been in contact with them. And they're doing some really good work, and they look to be releasing a CD in the near future and have some other bands and so forth. So people should check them out. And I'll have a link to their to Scholar's website, which then you can get to them. So, but this is a song that Scholar wrote looking at trust and maybe kind of looking at some of the stuff that's going on in the OTO and why so many difficulties are happening and why there's such a lack of trust. So listen to the lyrics. Thanks for listening to the podcast, and I hope you stick around for show 38 coming out in a few weeks. Love is the law. Love under will.
There are a lot of issues going on right now. But one topic which seems to cover all of them is trust. All I want is the freedom coming from New Aeon. But every time I turn my back, new drama's going on. Bishops are flipping and disciplined for people's blogs. Noses are sniffing in business as if we were dogs. And Gnostic mass, let's put the priestess on for cause. While Vegas is burning, we give the fire another log. The unaffiliated try to see through all the smog. And all the people standing up for freedom get flogged. And we're on the same team, supposedly love is law. But we can't agree, we seem to fight for a different cause. But who's the boss when everybody is a star? Our humanity's filled with flaws. Do we have enough gauze to care for all these scars and take a pause from applause and the cause that we floss? We get lost in this gloss and it costs us. Yet we trot along, and the only thing that's missing is Scholar to write another song. Trust, I wanna trust you. I wanna believe the seeds you speak will really be reaped. Trust, you wanna trust me, but all we see is each other screaming how much the other should just trust. I wanna trust you, I wanna believe the seeds you speak will really be reaped. Trust, you wanna trust me, but all we see is each other screaming how much the other should just trust. You can't trust me, cause I'm a fictitious entity, a literary device devised to fight for what's right. I'm not living in sin, I'm living in lust, impassioned by the path of the great work. And even though these words hurt a chosen few, I've gotta do whatever I can do to stay true to the smoothness in my integrity. I gotta speak out when they want appropriate speech out, and reach out to the people they would rather shut down. But morale's already at a low. flow, so I go to the next step. I wanna show that there's hope, but there's not much left, and this boat that we row hasn't got much depth. We the people have gotta be the reason we continue to be perceived as a human being, and we can give in to lust, in fact we must, but fraternity only works if we trust. I wanna trust you, I wanna believe the seeds you speak will really be reaped. Trust, you wanna trust me, but all we see is each other screaming how much the other should just trust. I wanna trust you, I wanna believe the seeds you speak will really be reaped. Trust, you wanna trust me, but all we see is each other screaming how much the other should just trust.
In our procedures and our officers, if you have no trust in either, then you really should simply step back from active membership until such a time as you feel that the situation has changed.